Hi, this is Paul, and I am back in Sacramento, as you can tell, and it's a little cool, so I'm wearing more layers, as you can tell. I wear more layers in church because there's no point in heating up a whole building because of me. I take Jimmy Carter's admonition to put on a sweater because it doesn't seem a good use of money to heat all of Livingstone's for my little own office. I do have a little space heater that I run sometimes, but Sacramento winters and falls are cool, but not cold, so putting on a sweater works fine. Gonna talk about ARC. Gonna get more perspective on this event after having been to the event, after the videos are coming out on the event. And my motivation for this isn't just the event itself or just talking about Jordan Peterson or anything like that. It has to do with the question of history and the world and how we participate in the world and how we act in the world. I'm going to talk about Eric Weinstein's conversation with Dave Rubin. But first, I want to talk about Philippa Stroud. Philippa Stroud is clearly one of the organizers of this event. I didn't know anything about her before I got there. A friend of mine there, who knows quite a bit about quite a few things, sort of filled me in on a lot of background in terms of she was a member of parliament. She was canceled for something. She was canceled a while ago for something she had written even further ago. She's an evangelical Christian. Her husband is a pastor of a very prominent, successful church in London. And so she had been a member of parliament, but then she got canceled. And so she's very active in the political space. You can find she opened the event. So what she gives Dave Rubin here in this event that's done about 12 days ago gives some background into the event and what they're looking for. So let's listen to her a little bit.
So can you talk about what ARC is, how Jordan got to you, and where you want to go with this thing?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So ARC is really a movement of people who are basically saying that we've had enough of a declinist, permacrisis, polycrisis type way of thinking. We actually believe that there is a better story, a better way forward, and a more hopeful narrative. And because we so believe in story, because it shapes who we are and it shapes our direction of travel as societies, that we actually want to come together to develop a better story for our society. But actually, when I think back to how it all started, I had invited Jordan to come and do a talk at the think tank that I led in London. And we had a fantastic time with him. The whole time we were focused on freedom of speech and higher education and how we restored freedom of speech and academic freedom back to our universities. And at the end of it, he went on his way, did a big tour around Eastern Europe. And halfway through that tour, he rang me and he said, "Philippa, everywhere I go, there are people, fantastic leaders, but they're so isolated and they're doing amazing work. What would happen if we brought them all together to do a conference in London?" And I thought, great story. And at the end of it, he just said to me, "Philippa, do you know this chap called Paul Marshall?" And I said, "Yeah, great friend of mine." So I pinged an email and said, "Hey, Jordan, meet Paul. Paul, meet Jordan. You're going to love each other." Next couple of days, Paul rings me and says, "You know this conference that you and Jordan are doing? I'm in." And I kind of thought, what conference? Anyway, it kind of just snowballed from there. And you know when like an idea's time has come, it just has momentum behind it and people wanting to get on board and make it happen. That's what ARC has been like from beginning to end.
I thought that was a super helpful little story, and it makes absolute sense of if you know anything about Jordan. Jordan, when he sees something, he acts on it. And Paul Marshall gave, I thought, one of the best speeches of the conference. I had no idea who Paul Marshall was. He's very much worth looking up. And so this just made complete sense to me that Jordan, so part of what Jordan has done for a while with his tour is Jordan will travel all around and then he'll sort of work his networks to find names of people who like him and people who know him would say, oh, he'll say, who's doing interesting things? And they'll bring them in and he'll talk to them backstage, or often he'll bring them in for a meal and there'll be a meal with, oh, a dozen people or so, and he'll get everyone talking. And So Jordan's just seen all of these cool things happening, and he wants to bring the people together, and he wants to sort of mobilize them together to get them to achieve something. And this is a this makes complete sense. Now, all the questions are going to be, okay, you can put them all in one place and hope that something sort of magical happens out of it. And will that be sort of 1,000 points of light? George H.W. Bush's phrase, will it be an organized attempt? And I don't think it's really clear, and I don't think that the organizers of this thing necessarily are committed to it being clear. I think they sort of put together a fairly standard conference format, bringing people together, hoping something good will come out of it. And I saw this one video that someone had put that ARC has failed. And I thought, that is the exact wrong way to think about this thing. As if at this point you could know if something has failed or not failed. It's impossible to know, because it's really impossible to know exactly what this thing is about. What it is sort of bringing a bunch of people together, doing some talks, seeing what happened. I filled out the post-conference evaluation today. That's pretty standard for conferences, pre-conference, post-conference, yada, yada, yada. So what she said there, I think, is important. Now, you can go back and look at the three videos that I made day one, day two, day three of the conference. Day one, asking questions about, can you actually go back? Because the conference very much had a tone of recapturing classical liberalism that has been lost and is under assault. It's under assault from the left, and it's under assault from the right. The second video I had was a Q&A live stream with a bunch of people coming in, and we talked about the conference. That's the one that Tayo was with me for. And the third video, after the Peugeot talk, and again, it's vitally important not just to sort of see the Peugeot talk on the internet out there, but to understand the Peugeot talk in the context of the conference. Because it was the third day, and we had just talk after talk after talk, all this talk about energy and prosperity and liberty and liberalism. There was a lot of political speeches, all of this, and especially sort of the arts crew. And I'm hoping to have a conversation with some of that arts crew that Peugeot had brought in. They had been getting quite frustrated. And then Jonathan sort of, I think, revealed something about the conference, especially for me, after a number of days in the UK. Again and again and again, in Germany, the Netherlands, and Europe, I would hear Christians talking about the fact that they kept their Christian faith quiet and private because they knew they would lose status in the public secular sphere if people learned that they were committed Christians, if people learned that they actually believed many of these things that Christians believe. And so I very much saw this as sort of, and I talked about feminine energy, as sort of the way in which this group of people, not all of whom are Christians, are trying to set a new course in a variety of ways. How exactly they will set a new course in a variety of ways, difficult to tell. Now, I know nothing about Klaus Schwab or the World Economic Forum. That sort of is the way this is often pitched sometimes. I don't know the way in which the World Economic Forum actually exerts influence, but and for that reason, I don't exactly know the way this thing plans to assert influence rather than hoping to bring people together, help them network, so on and so forth. So that's the vision. And I think I'm going to have conversations with, I've got my conversation with Rafe Kelly all scheduled. I want to have a conversation with Nathan Jacobs. I want to have a conversation with Glenn Scrivener. And I want to have a conversation with some of the artists that were there too. I have yet to propose that to them, but we'll hopefully get that going. So, and with others to continue to sort of chew on this and talk about this, because I think this is one of the avenues that Jordan hopes to bring change to the world in a direction that he thinks it should happen. There's obviously Peterson Academy. someone said, when is Jordan going to do a dating service? And I thought, yeah, dating service would make complete sense for Jordan. I mean, he's got the personality stuff. Jordan could totally launch a dating service. But anyway, we'll see if they ever do that. Now I want to turn to Dave Rubin's talk with Eric Weinstein. Now, the title of this video is aptly titled, I'm Afraid Liberal Values Can't Defeat This Threat, Eric Weinstein. And a number of people have already, I didn't mean to go that far. That's a pretty good thumbnail. Should capture that. Besides being this conference that was, as Philippa Stroud described, it was also sort of a IDW summit as such. Many of the IDW characters were there. Ben Shapiro eventually appeared at the O2. Eric Weinstein was there. Brett and Heather were there. Jordan was there. There was no Joe Rogan that I could see. It was also clear that there was sort of the 1,500 of us who were out there, kind of the conference participants, and there were clearly a number of more inner ring backstage things happening. They refer to it here. I thought, in all fairness, since I've been talking about these people's work, I would go up and at least introduce myself and just extend a friendly handshake. And everyone that I did that to, Brett and Heather, they both received me warmly. And Eric, to Eric's credit, paid more attention than many did. Now, the conference is super frenetic. There's a lot of people around. One person commented to me that the effect that they'd have if you were sort of a low status person is you'd talk to someone. If you're talking to a higher status person, they're always looking over your shoulder, scanning the room, in the words of a friend of mine who works in politics, looking for a bigger name. And so there was sort of a lot of that. And so Brett and Heather were very kind to me. Eric, to his credit, basically said, I don't think you have me right. I said, okay, well, I'd be more than happy for you to set me straight on who you are and what you care about. And he said, okay, I'll do that. And part of me thought, he's never going to get back to me the way this conference is going. And so then the third day, he spent more time on the floor amidst the normal people than many of sort of the top tier celebrities did. So I'm going to give Eric a lot of credit for that, because he did spend a lot of time on the floor mingling with people. And so then the third day, he was talking to Kurt Jemungle, and I stopped him and I said, I haven't forgotten you want to talk to me about this, and I'm around. But he was busy at that moment. Again, it's sort of catch as catch can. So then later in the day, I said to him again, if you want to go do this, I can do this now. He said, okay, let's do this now. And he sort of pulled me out of the room into a little alcove that was quite a bit more private. And then he sort of started out, well, what do you want to know? And then I thought, well, you were going to set me straight on you. And so we started talking a little bit. And in the end, I saw that, number one, we weren't going to have enough time to really have a real conversation. And already there was a certain intensity to the conversation that I didn't know would sort of set the table for the way I usually like to have a conversation, which is usually taking time and getting to know each other and so on and so forth. So he talked about the things that he talks on this video, but it was very compressed. He talked about, you know, how the end is coming and how people don't see it. And okay, so, but again, didn't really have time to unpack that. And he unpacks a lot more of that here with Dave Rubin. So this video was very helpful. And I saw that I wasn't, if you only have 2 or 3 minutes to make a connection with someone, make a positive connection. That's sort of my way into it. So then he had talked to me. I think he'd sort of come at me in the sense that perhaps I was not treating him fairly because although he's an atheist, he's deeply committed to religious practices. And I can understand that. I asked him why, and we talked about that a little bit. And all of that was fine. But he talked about prayer and the importance of prayer. So then I just sort of said, well, would you let me pray for you? And so then he let me pray for him. So I just prayed a simple prayer of blessing for himself and his family and his work. And, you know, we left amicably with a smile and a handshake, and it was all good. But I think this video is important because it very much gets at a lot of the stuff that I talked about in the video I made after day one. Because the conference was, in many ways, making noises about a return to liberalism. And as I said in that video, you can't really go back. And so, what then? How to move forward? And what's good about this video is you very much get a sense of where Eric is at in terms of, while the attack from the left says liberalism is insufficient to bring justice on the earth, and they have their own group of, let's say, wokish tools in order to try to bring out a just society, Eric is quite a bit more pessimistic, and he and Brett tend to continue to hit this same note. Brett never with sort of the, or not usually with sort of the intensity and apocalypticism that Eric brings to it. But let's, but this is basically the skepticism that he has with respect. He doesn't name it directly here, but this is what he's talking about at the conference. Now, some of you have noted this is a tiny little booth. Someone who has worked in this for Peterson and Vervaeke, who does film stuff, set up a bunch of pods. I think this was a genius move. Set up a bunch of pods so that podcasters could just step in there and do something, and which I think was really very smart for this effort. So that's why the room is so small. It's right there on site. Dave Rubin was around a bit, and Eric was around a bit, and a bunch of other people was around a bit. I did a thing with Peter Boghossian that I'm sure will come out at some point on Peter's channel. And yeah, here we go.
It's been 84 years. No, it's been a long time. We had to come to London to do this together. We've got 25 minutes. We had dinner last night. You're, I would say, on it when it comes to the state of the world right now, and your concerns are the things that I think everyone is concerned about right now.
What Dave doesn't do is sort of connect the dots here. And those dots are important to connect because you're at a conference where they're touting free speech, free markets, basically old classical liberal approach to improve the world. And Eric isn't having it.
I hand you that.
Really appreciate it. Don't know what to do exactly. You know, one of the things that came out of the discussion last night is that I don't think we are where we think we are. I give the analogy that if you have a river that has always been flowing and one year you have unseasonably cold temperatures, it freezes over. People think they can do what they've always done. They can dive off the rock into the river, and if they're going to hit ice one year and they realize that you have to change your behavior when there's a phase change. I think that many of the recourses that we've thought about, free markets, free speech, democracy, have to be rethought if they become gamed. And I think one of the things that we're experiencing is we don't know.
Okay, right there. Basically, the conference is about democracy, free speech, free markets, free thought. And Eric basically says these things have been gamed. And this is actually a theme that Eric has been bringing forward a lot. If you listen to his episodes of The Portal, one of my favorites was his conversation with Douthat, because of course, Douthat, he basically said, he asked Douthat, if Jesus were alive today, wouldn't Jesus just get memed to death? And Douthat kind of chuckles and says, well, I think that's sort of the definition of the Son of God, that that Jesus would not be memed to death. And my argument would be that Jesus still has not been memed to death. But what he said right there is really key, because again, in this little gray box here, in the Rubin report, Dave Rubin isn't expanding it, except to talk, well, we had this you know, little dinner last night and he was talking about it, but he's not connecting the dots with respect to the conference. And so this is Eric's pessimism with respect to this effort that it can actually achieve its outcomes.
Whether Gingrich thought about free markets, free speech, democracy, have to be rethought if they become gamed. And I think one of the things that we're experiencing is we don't know whether to roll back to a previous version of ourselves, which would be like trying to find safe mode on a computer where the operating system has become corrupted, or whether we need to go forward for things that aren't capitalism or communism, aren't democracy, because in fact, there's been a phase change in our world. And I think...
And again, this is directed to the conference and to the ARC effort.
What we're doing is avoiding the question of, you know, for example, if Hamas is a democratically elected government and it engages in pure terror, is democracy what we think it is? Does free speech...
That is a profound question, and that is not a new question. These questions were floating around 100 years ago. We should remember that part of the rise of fascism and communism were because people in the 20s and 30s were suspecting that maybe liberal democracy's time has passed. It's been around a while. It was an older system than, let's say, fascism or communism. Communism was the new thing. There was a lot of excitement about communism. There was a lot of good propaganda coming out of Russia. Now, a lot of stuff were being covered up. But if you go back to the 1920s and 1930s, there was a lot of intellectuals were very excited about communism and the Soviet Union, that this was the way forward in the future. It seemed that Russia had sort of leapt forward ahead of everything because they leapfrogged over liberal democracies, going right from this sort of medieval system of czars and peasants all the way into this new world. They pushed forward in terms of mechanization and industrialization. Now, of course, looking back on communism, our perspective is very, very different, but it's important to remember that these questions about democracy and liberalism are very old. And now this is basically an updating of the skepticism with respect to it, because Eric asserts that these things have been gamed, and if they are gamed, they will no longer produce what they were designed to produce, and therefore, can you really go back? Probably not. Then we're going to need a new system. But okay, but what new system? And again, as I said in the first video, after ARC Day 1, there are a lot of people who are saying this, not just someone like Eric, who's got his own particular perspectives, but even in some ways, some of the, you know, Jonathan Peugeot at the O2 conference, when asked the question about pluralism and diversity, basically pointed to an emperor. And it's like, oh, back to that. Now, it's helpful to remember that democracy actually is a way to try to avoid difficult things that were part of the both monarchical and imperial worlds, where you had wars of succession. That democracy, basically, where you have leaders who move, let's say the American system, where you don't have a king, you just have presidents who are sort of like kings, but not really like kings. There's checks and balances. Of course, you have places like the King of England, the King of the Netherlands, the King of Spain, yada, yada, yada. But these are constitutional monarchies where the governments can change, but the king remains the same, but the king stays out of politics. Maybe, hopefully, not hopefully, I have to figure that out. So I don't think Eric's questions are bad. I think Eric's questions have to be faced. The difficulty that we have is that it's unclear at this point that we actually have a model that is better than the one we currently have. And it's also unclear that, let's say, a model can be thought of and then sort of implemented rather than the way that human beings in history tend to develop new models, which usually is sort of groping forward, usually with a lot of messiness and bloodshed, and then new things emerge. And I, too, have a lot of skepticism about, let's say, a return to imperial dynasties or monarchies. I'm not sort of dismissing them, because, again, there are monarchies that are functioning in the world. We just had the coronation of Charles III, et cetera, et cetera. But when I listen to, let's say, the critics of liberalism from the religious posture or from the right, I don't really see them talking about the kind of monarchs or monarchies we have today. Now, I think someone who is a critic of liberalism from the right, someone like Rod Dreher, who has moved to Hungary, he keeps pointing to Hungary as sort of the model of the way forward, but I don't really see Hungary as necessarily doing a lot of innovation with respect to governance. And governance was a piece of the ARC conference. So let's hear a little bit more.
Each operate the same way if you have armies of bots that can confuse people into thinking that there's a mass of people who believe something, which there isn't on day one, but by virtue of the power of persuasion and social coercion, people are afraid to hold simple, decent perspectives, because every time they do it, they're torn apart by what seems to be 10,000 accounts telling them that they're an idiot, that they're cringeworthy, that they're...
Now, he's right in that this is a new innovation now with social media. But again, in the 1920s and 30s, there's a lot of skepticism about democracy because of the new science of propaganda that was emerging during that time, and mass media and mass advertising.
Over that they're barbarous. And I watched this happen to you.
You've seen my Twitter account, my God.
Well, that's the thing, right? And I saw the repetition through what psychologists would call perseveration, where, they would just hit you with the same phrases over and over again. And it causes people to move away from you because we have evolutionary programs. So I think one of the things that I believe is that, if I think about the early work you and I did together, we were talking about fake news and what was coming. Yeah, it was pretty prophetic. So that stuff held up pretty well.
You're on the short list of people that I would say the interviews actually do stand up, and we're ballpark
right back at
you. Or let's say directionally right about where this was going to go.
Sure.
Unfortunately, we're sort of in the prequel version of Star Wars now when Yoda says, "Well, failed we have." That seems like, in some respect...
Well, and somebody tries to execute orders.
Now, for all of the pessimism about today, and I hear a lot from many different sides, I also don't hear a lot of concrete positive vision about the future. And what I mean by that is, this is a point that G.K. Chesterton had made, that a lot of the navigating we do tends to be sort of opposite of, we don't want this, we don't want that, we don't want this, we don't want that. It's sort of reactive. Figuring out what we do want, what does work well going forward, that's much harder.
We're 66, and so the Jedi, were put under a lot of pressure. But one of the things that I really appreciate is the number of people who've had their relationships strained by the relentless attack we've all been under. You used to be a liberal and a lefty. I'm still in that position. And the fact is that we're still talking.
We're still here, man.
Well, and a large number of us never stop talking to each other. Some people have stopped talking to us, but one of the things that I think is really impressive is the extent to which we have held together. And even if I disagree with some of the positions...
Now, if you haven't seen the trigonometry conversation with Sam Harris and Eric Weinstein, it's really worth watching. Partly just because where Sam Harris goes in this, which is near genocidal, and Eric keeps trying to sort of push him back from the brink. Say, well, now, what exactly do you mean in this, Sam?
You've now adopted whatever.
So the degree to which these groups have hung together, I don't know. I mean, you've got this... Sam Harris was not at ARC. Sam Harris and Brett Weinstein, who had a major conversation a couple of years ago that I covered pretty extensively. They're not having conversations now. I don't think we're about to see, some of the early things, I think it was I'd have to go back and look, Eric and Brett and Jordan and Ben Shapiro with Dave Rubin. I don't think we're going to see these together. So in fact, a lot of this talk has broken down, and the difficulty that I have, while I understand Eric's skepticism and maybe even some of his pessimism, I don't really see alternatives to these liberal values.
The same rules go. Yeah. So what I was going to say is, if we want to do the same thing we were doing all those years ago, we have to figure out what are the edgy things nobody's prepared to think that unfortunately are going to be prophetic. And I think one of them is going to be that you can't simply keep invoking democracy, the free movement of people, diversity is our strength, et cetera, because it's going into a place that's going to be anything but tolerant. We're going to have to learn, for example, that we must be intolerant of intolerance to be tolerant. It's like multiplying -1 times -1 to get a positive number. And I think people are afraid that they're going to have to turn against things that have always been true, but like that winter where suddenly things are colder than usual, the river stops flowing the way it always has, and you have to watch it.
So again, it's not directly in this video, but the ARC conference is in the background here, and Eric is not sort of connecting the dots for us saying, I'm skeptical about this conference. I'm skeptical about this effort. And I think that's what he thinks. Questions will be, okay, ARC wants to sort of bring people together, to have people have the conversation. Well, some of this is happening. I think it's better to just say, to have Eric say, I'm skeptical about the direction that this ARC conference goes. Now, maybe he's trying to maintain these relationships and he doesn't want to come out and be overt with respect to this. So, and then basically, Eric and Brett are on the same page that, well, we're going to have to, Eric often will say things we have to get off this rock. And then Eric will talk about physics, which I don't understand. I'm not a physicist by any means. And talk about space exploration and colonization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which at least from anything I know is not even in, whereas the threats are in the very near future. Space exploration does not appear like it's going to in any way sort of get us out of anything like the mess that we have here. We are deeply tied to the planet that we are on. So listen to the whole video. But I think it's helpful, again, to understand when you look at the three videos that I made about ARC, my embrace of the, when I embrace the project in video 3, I'm not necessarily saying, oh, I'm really down for sort of this half step back to classical liberalism. I am skeptical that you can't, in fact, instantiate that. I think, in fact, you do have to move forward. But as, let's say, in distinction with Eric Weinstein, I don't see viable alternatives beyond some of these liberal values, including democracy. And I haven't really seen anybody proposing viable paths forward. Now, again, being in Europe is always a thing that sort of opens me up to some complexity of the world that I don't necessarily experience in the United States. In the United States, we have these laboratories that are states that are sort of under the dome of the federal government. In Europe, you have these little nations that could potentially be places for experimentation of new ways of statehood and such. It's just very difficult because you have all of these little states in Europe, and economically, in terms of their population, they're not really in a position to try anything big. China, in many ways, is a grand experiment in a bunch of new things. It doesn't, to me, look very hopeful in terms of affording some of the liberty that I think is actually vitally important for people to thrive. And I think we see that in terms of the numbers of people that want to come to the developed West. So, but I did want to mention this video, and I did want to add context to this video. And I wanted to, again, as with the video I made after day one in the ARC, note that these tensions are in the discussion, and that's a good thing. And I hope that within this larger ARC effort, that number one, they can keep these tensions in the conversation. Whether or not ARC decides it's going to be within their focus, their mission to sort of facilitate this or just continue to allow these things to sort of happen on the fringes of it, I don't know. That would be a call by them. But again, given Jonathan Peugeot's place on this leadership team, you know, on one of my conversations with Jonathan, he basically says, you know, he's a monarchist. And then I remind him, well, you do have a king after all. And again, for many of the monarchists, they kind of take, well, this isn't the monarchy that I'm looking for. Okay, well, what exactly is the monarchy that you're looking for? And how can you bring a real body in this world towards that? I think that is the challenge. Now, on many of Eric's videos, I often hear him say things like, well, if anyone would listen to me, and that always sort of falls flat to me because he's got his site, you know, he had his own podcast and he's dropped it for whatever reason he did. It isn't that he's necessarily lacking for opportunities to get out messages on the internet. And to have people complain that people aren't listening to me, well, fair enough. Nobody listens to anyone, and many of the voices that most of us listen to, we have, we perhaps for one reason or another think they're unworthy. And so it kind of becomes this, well, why don't you let me run the world and I'll do it right? It's like, well, it's there's a lot of people in line for that position, and it seldom goes well. You're going to need a path and a plan to actually do this, and I don't know what it is. So I wanted to bring this video in and talk about this a little bit and continue to talk about this ARC conference. Now, I'm going to be having some offline conversation with some people about this that won't be recorded, but that will continue to sort of fill in my thinking, and we'll also be doing some online conversation. One of the things that's important to remember is that the world is very big. And we are not in control of it. We are not in charge of it. And this aspiration for God-like mastery of the world is a very dangerous thing. If you read in Genesis 3, this begins with our first parents. And so even sort of getting right the formula, or at least the agency and mode of being and acting to be a positive influence in the world is something worth thinking very carefully about. Now, I, of course, as you know, am a Christian, and so my MO for world shaping comes from Jesus Christ. And I would argue that Jesus Christ is the most influential person in human history. He's more influential than Genghis Khan. He's more influential than Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. And the mode in which Jesus was influential is remarkable. He never wrote a book. We just have four canonical books of his sayings and acts. We have writings from Paul of Tarsus, and we have the Hebrew Scriptures. And these have demonstrated a remarkable power to shape the world so far. Now, part of the best part about having a YouTube channel that is not so big that I can't listen to everyone, or a Twitter account, is that people bring really important stuff to me because they know what I listen to, they know what's up my alley, and so they just at me on Twitter and I get attention. So 2242 in a recent video with Brett and Heather, we have these traditions that are clearly not up to the challenge for navigating modern hazards. So let's take a look at that.
The figure of G.K. Chesterton figures large in this book, and many of my listeners will be familiar with this quote that does not appear in Hunter-Gatherer's Guide. When a man stops believing in God, he doesn't then believe in nothing. He believes in anything. Heather, how do you react to that? You guys are not proponents of any particular religion, although I was delighted to learn you do celebrate Hanukkah in your own special way at the very end. But what does that mean to you? Is Chesterton, you know, can we selectively apply Chestertonians quips when it suits our fancy, as in the case of the fence? Or what do you make of this, the believe in nothing, if doesn't believe in nothing, he believes in everything. Is God some sort of connective tissue, and what purpose does evolutionary speaking, does God serve?
Well, that's a fascinating quote, and it's not one I've heard. So let me take first the question about whether or not we can selectively choose the thinking of a person and not embrace their entire milieu. And I would say, of course we can, right? Mm-hmm. So let me just take a step aside from your question for a moment and say specifically the contribution of Chesterton that we introduce in the book introduce within the confines of the book, not to the world, but right. is Chesterton's fence, the idea that if you see a fence and you don't know what its purpose is, you should not be allowed nor courage to get rid of it until and unless you can demonstrate that you know what its function was supposed to be, and presumably also demonstrate that it no longer has that function or it is in fact causing more harm than good. And so we then apply that more broadly and say we see Chesterton's fences all over the modern world in the form of Chesterton's breast milk, Chesterton's play, and Chesterton's religions. So to get to your point here, you know, what role does religion have in the modern world? Well, the idea that it is that we're done with it, that it was a maladaptation, that it was a dangerous or a mind virus, cannot hold up to evolutionary scrutiny. Right. Every society that we know of has some form of religion in which the people in it, the majority of people in it, until the very modern times in which we are living in, you know, multivariate societies, multi-religious societies, has belief, and it helps organize morality, frankly. And the idea that it is somehow additional to cheesecake for humans is just doesn't fit. And I wonder, I suspect that Brett has more to say on this, perhaps.
Yeah, I think the problem, you know, we do talk about Chesterton's fence specifically in the context of religion, but, you know, we have these two concepts that we discussed. There's the precautionary principle and there's Chesterton's fence, and they're really mirror images of each other. One is about the hazard of adding novel things to a system, and the other is about taking away things that have been longstanding. And again, this goes back to the arbitrariness of the place we find ourselves in history, because we have these traditions. The traditions are clearly not up to the challenge of navigating modern hazards. You know, the Bible has precious little to say about social media and the hazards of algorithms to our collective sense making.
Well, I would actually push back on that, right? Because there are traits, I mean, you may know from your upbringing, there's a notion of what's called lashon hara, the evil speech in Judaism, at least, which is the notion that gossip is not something that's false. In other words, you're forbidden to lie in general, so you wouldn't be forbidden again to tell something. So it's something that's true. Gossip is true, and yet it's spreads like wildfire more than ever. And the analogy that's used typically in the Talmud is one of a man besmirches the reputation of his rabbi and says, oh, he's been married and divorced or whatever, and that's not, you know, socially a great thing for this particular man. And the parishioner then feels guilty and says, how can I rectify what I did to your rabbi? And the rabbi says, simple, just go get a feather pillow. And the guy goes, okay, I'll go get a feather pillow, that's it, that seems simple. The rabbi says, no, cut it open. The guy says, all right, I'll cut open the pillow. And he goes, and shake it out. And the guy says, all right, I'll do it. And am I forgiven? And he goes, no, now go out and collect all the feathers. The notion being that, you know, the ability to produce BS and actually truth far outstrips the ability to do it. But the notion of guarding your tongue, the actual quote in the Torah, in the Old Testament, the Bible, is, you know, you should.
Okay, so he gave that illustration. This is a point that I've made a number of times with respect to this point that, that Brett has made before, in that often when I hear the challenge, it's that, well, the Bible doesn't have social media, the Bible doesn't have enriched uranium, the Bible doesn't have the release of carbon from sequestered fuels such as coal, petroleum, et cetera, et cetera. The Bible doesn't give this, but all of this sort of assumes that the way the Bible works and the way religion works is that you have this group of commands. And now, I don't want to say too much about any particular religion, but that basically what the Bible is this code of this: do this, don't do that; do this, don't do that; do this, don't do that. Well, there certainly are do this, don't do that things in the Bible, but what happens in religion is that these things continue to get interpreted and adapted through. And so just because the Bible doesn't tell you whether or not you should have a smartphone or go on social media doesn't mean that the Bible doesn't have anything to say against it or about it or give us wisdom in terms of engaging it. And in fact, the project of religion constantly deals with the updating of the world and trying to maintain a narrative thread through the world in order to figure out how to engage the world, even when the particulars of the world continue to change. So if you imagine that the way religion will operate in the future is that religion will give a set of rules and tell people what to do and what not to do, and if they do what they're supposed to do and they don't do what it says not to do, then suddenly what? Religion doesn't function that way at all. Part of the reason being, many of the things that almost every religion without fail, and even many people who are not religious, are told what not to do, and people do it anyway, shows that that posture in and of itself doesn't work. To go all the way back to Philippa Stroud's main point is that what religions instead do is frame a reality. And in that frame of reality, you get into ideas of where finally is our hope. And I would assert that most of these individuals are working from an atheist materialist frame that says that material is primary and mind, spirit, all of this is secondary and derivative from that which is primary. And then you go all the way back to Peugeot's point in his main speech. Religions basically invert that and say spirit is primary and matter is secondary. The laws of physics govern the movement of particles. The movement of particles don't govern the laws of physics. Now, of course, physicists, mathematicians, they're going to debate this, but this is the basic inversion and the basic posture that we are working from. So I think the conversation with respect to religion goes much deeper. And I'm not going to get into it right now, but if you get into, let's say, the Jordan Peterson, John Lennox conversation that they had, I thought that was a fascinating conversation. And what I want to do is put it next to some of Alistair McGrath's biography of C.S. Lewis, because I think McGrath, because I was going to some of these Lewis sites in Oxford and I visited them, I thought it would be good to reread some Lewis stuff. And so I looked at The Narnian, which is sort of a favorite biography of Lewis by Alan Jacobs. But then I went to an event in Edinburgh with Alistair McGrath, which I thought was a terrific event. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to look back at Alistair McGrath's. And I think McGrath, who had the chair of science and religion at Oxford, and who Brett has had a conversation with on Unbelievable, I don't know that that conversation went as far and as deep as it could have, part of the difficulty with sort of the way this works with sort of high profile fandoms is that people would look and say, Alistair McGrath is the best person for Brett Weinstein to talk about. The difficulty is that Brett Weinstein probably hasn't really read any of Alistair McGrath's books or know his work very deeply. And Alistair McGrath doesn't really know Brett Weinstein's work or his perspective. So that when they talk, you can't get very far because so much of the time is either just proposing their usual positions that they use, that they're accustomed to giving out on their talks, or trying to figure out what the other one is saying, rather than spending a little bit more time with both of them to begin to say, okay, well, one of the things that I like about Brett's work is that he does sort of have the two-track. He recognizes the importance of the culture track as well as the physical biological track. And I think that's to Brett's credit. But this deep divide that Peugeot pointed his finger at the ARC conference is obviously a presuppositional divide that is going to continue to divide those who believe that matter is primary and spirit is secondary or derivative versus those who believe that spirit is primary and matter is secondary, and that in fact spirit governs matter and spirit will always govern matter, and anyone who is making any arguments about human behavior or especially human thought in many ways already has admitted implicitly that matter is governed and colonized by spirit. Because when you're using arguments and language, you are basically in the realm of spirit, hoping that it will govern the material world. So that's it for this. Leave a comment. Let me know what you think. I know I'm going to get a lot of crap from some of you for even talking about Brett and Eric, because I know for some of you, that ship has sailed. I understand that. You can leave your comment. That's fine. But I still listen to both of them on occasion, especially when someone points out things. I do find, of the two, I think I'm more skittish around Eric, but I tend to find what he says a little bit more stimulating. I can trust Brett a little bit more, especially because of Heather. I think the way those two work together is just really remarkable, but I don't know how much either of them is really going to move from where they're at. So I'll say that. Leave a comment. Let me know what you think.